Today we will continue our series on the book of Exodus, and we are calling our series on the book of Exodus, Set Free, Live Free. And we've been studying the power of God's liberating love in the life of ancient Israel, how he took them out of really intense and really dark slavery in Egypt, and how he's teaching them now what it looks like to live as his free people. And I don't know about you guys, but I would expect Israel to be a little bit more humble, maybe a little bit more thankful about this whole deal, about what God has done. But most of the time, since God has set them free, they're complaining and they're not trusting that God has their best in mind, the spiritual equivalent of like a really whiny teenager. And the past few Exodus messages have been about God's provision for Israel, but today it'll almost be about kind of God's protection for Israel. So in chapter 17, you could almost say that it's protection from external problems, and it's protection in chapter 18 from internal problems. And so that's where we will be today in Exodus chapter 17. If you want to get out your copy of the scriptures and go to Exodus 17, we'll get there in a few minutes, Exodus 17 in your Bibles. Now, as you are getting there, I have something that I would love for you to consider with me just for a couple minutes. I've kind of been asking people about this all week, which is some of my favorite kind of sermon prep, and here's what I need you to consider, just a question. When does leadership fail? When does leadership fail? I hope that doesn't sound too negative, but I do think it's easier for us to recognize it when it's not as it should be. And please do this. Don't think too technically about it. This is more than just your boss, or this is more than just executives. Think about spheres of influence. Define leadership like that. And now think about it broadly like that. When does leadership fail? Had some good conversations and good answers to this question this past week. I'd love to hear yours. That'd be great to get coffee and talk about that maybe. But here are just a couple things that I'm thinking of. I think leadership fails when it becomes more power hungry than people focused. So when that happens, people become a means to an end, and then those in leadership start looking down at people. I think leadership also fails when it decides to promote personal preferences over what they clearly know is better for the people that are being led. And this is a big one, and if you've read a leadership book or two, you probably know that this is true. I think leadership also fails when it's not delegated. But here's the deal, I want to push that just a little bit. I'm not talking about delegated tasks. Okay, you need to go do this. Everybody knows that needs to happen. Make sure this gets done, blah, blah, blah. I'm talking about something more specific. Delegated trust, which is way more fragile, way more subjective, and way more important in my mind. I'm talking about not just encouraging people or empowering people or go, hey, way to go, you can do this, but actually believing and having faith in that person that they feel it and then setting them free for the greater good. I think that's important. And I think when leadership doesn't do that, it fails. Matt Densky is our new student ministry pastor. Hopefully you just saw him up on the screen a second ago. Matt's a good friend of mine, and Matt used to teach this leadership class at Columbia International University. And he got a little too giddy when I asked him this question, but his answer was great. He said the following: leadership has to include experience, character, and skill. Experience, character, and skill. And when one of those three is drastically lacking, then that organization's or that person's leadership is not going to be sufficient. If experience, character, or skill, if one's lacking. We could keep thinking about this, and I do think it's healthy to critique things with an eye toward change. But I also think that those people under leadership, sometimes they get way too much out of it when they complain about the leadership above them or around them, okay? I know you've never done that, but I'm just saying if someone were to complain, it gives them this personal sense of justification, like trash talking your boss when they're not around, which I know, I mean, somebody in your family struggles with that, but not you. So your boss is not there, and you're just saying stuff about them when they're not present. And what that does is slowly and subconsciously, it makes you think that you're above them somehow. Not on the pay scale, but somehow you think you're more evolved than they are. Or demeaning the coach of your team when it's just the players that are around, right? And it gives you this inflated sense of value of what you bring to the team that maybe somebody else on the team doesn't share if you demean your coach when he's not there. And this is a big one. It doesn't matter who our president is. I'll go ahead and tell you right now. Everybody in here, somehow, some way, you're probably going to try to find something to whine about and bicker about politically. You know why? Because it coddles your pride. If you can see things that those in leadership clearly can't see, because they don't read the blogs you read, man. If they watch the news that you watch, they would understand how the world works. Man, if people in political leadership knew what we know, the world would be a better place. That's how we think. And this is actually really funny. And kind of poignant. This is why religion and politics are so fragile in the public square. This is what you got to get. Here's the connection between the two. Both are about who's really in charge, who really gets the right to lead the world. That's why religion and politics are both so fragile in the public square. And this kind of walks us up to the relationship between Christianity and leadership. And in Christianity, everything is flipped. In Mark chapter 10, Jesus says, the world's leadership operates from the top down with authority and power and control. And then Jesus said to his followers, it should not be so among you. Rather, if you want to be great, you should learn to be the servant of all. So greatness in God's kingdom is all about servanthood. In fact, the Greek word for servant there in Mark 10 is actually slave. It's the lowest place on the social totem pole in the first century. And that means that Christianity's leadership structures are not top-down with authority and force. Christianity operates from the bottom up, and this is why the center of the Christian message is a Jewish rabbi from a small town who died naked on a cross for sinners. Or as Jesus says in the same passage, I did not come to be served, but to serve and give my life as a ransom for many. And now we have this really hard equation in front of us. How are we supposed to do? We're called to, as Christians, how we need to think about doing biblical servant leadership from the bottom up in a culture that often does this top-down leadership that's power-hungry quite often, and it's about authority and force. When the kingdom of heaven comes crashing into earth, when God's future comes backward into the present in Jesus, there will be friction, and this is a perfect example of it. And how you process these things should change how you lead and how you respond to leadership, no matter where you are in life, no matter your sphere of influence. And that means that how you lead and how you respond to leadership is one of the truest commentaries on how you understand God. That's scary. You need to think about that Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. in a meeting. How you lead and respond to leadership is one of the truest commentaries on how you understand God. So what you think about it and what you do about it, it's going to reveal what's in your heart, what you assume about God to be true. So here's what we have to consider this morning. Is there a way to think about leadership that's going to elevate our view of God and it's going to empower those who lead and those who follow? Is there a way that we can think about this thing that's going to make us think more of God and make us more faithful as leaders and those being led? Can we think about it and make us more hungry to follow and humble to lead and more quick to trust God? And I think there is a way to do this, and I think the book of Exodus can help us out with that this morning. So here's the deal. We're going to start in Exodus chapter 17, if you have your Bibles out. Exodus chapter 17, we're going to start in verse 8, and here's a little warning for you. We're going to read a lot of Bible this morning. A lot of Bible. So my encouragement to you is this. Getting lost in Bible details is very fun, and if you don't think it is, then we probably can't be friends. That's all right. You need to do that on your own time. But this morning, we need to think in big, broad strokes because we have a lot to cover. We're going to read from Exodus 17, verse 8, all the way through the end of chapter 18. And we've got to keep this in our brains. Is there a way to think about leadership that elevates our view of God and empowers those who lead and those who follow? Here we go. Exodus 17, verse 8. Then Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, choose for us men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. Verse 10. So Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek while Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. Whenever Moses held his hand up, Israel prevailed. And whenever he lowered his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands grew weary. So they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur held up his hands, one on one side and one on the other. So his hands were steady until the going down of the sun, and Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and the people and his people with the sword. Verse 14. Then Yahweh said to Moses, write this as a memorial in a book and recite it in the ears of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven, which, by the way, is the first time the writing of the Bible is mentioned in the Bible. So that's a fun side note. You can think about that later. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it, Yahweh is my banner, saying, a hand upon the throne of Yahweh, Yahweh will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. Stop. We don't, historically speaking, know a lot about the Amalekites. What we do know is that they were like desert pirates, okay? There's this big desert below the Promised Land, and these guys roamed, and they lived in this desert, and they were always, because Israel was right above them, at this point they're coming up beside them, but they were always attacking Israel and threatening Israel, and that's why it was really relevant to include this story, because the original readers of Exodus would know about the Amalekites. And we also need to remember, we got to read Exodus like the original readers of Exodus. And they would have been far more familiar with Joshua and his leadership. They probably didn't know Mo. Mo was dead and gone by the time the original readers were checking this out. But they likely knew Joshua. And this is the first time that Joshua is included in the whole Bible. And it's in a leadership context. And that's important for the first readers of Exodus. And that, so we have to keep that in mind. But we also have a lot to cover. So let's go 18:1. Chapter 18, verse 1. Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for the people of Israel, and how Yahweh had brought Israel out of Egypt. Now Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, had taken Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her home along with her two sons. The name of one was Gershom, because Moses said, I've been a sojourner in a foreign land. And the name of the other, Eleazar, because he said, the God of my father was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. Verse 5, now Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife in the wilderness where he was encamped at the mountain of God. And when he sent word to Moses, I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons. Moses went out to meet his father-in-law and bowed down and kissed him. Apparently they had a great relationship. And they asked each other of their welfare and went into the tent. Verse 8. Then Moses told his father-in-law all that Yahweh had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and all the hardship that had come upon them in the way, and how Yahweh had delivered them. And Jethro rejoiced for all the good that Yahweh had done to Israel, and that he had delivered them out of the hand of the Egyptians. Verse 10. And Jethro said, blessed be Yahweh who has delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh and delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that Yahweh is greater than all the gods because in this affair, the Egyptians dealt arrogantly with the people of Israel. Verse 12. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, brought a burnt offering and sacrifices to God. And Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God. Pause. Hopefully you gathered by these dozen verses that Jethro is Moses' father-in-law. Not sure if you caught that, but this is actually important to keep in mind. Jethro, not kidding, the reason it repeats it so much is because Jethro isn't part of the family. He's a non-Israelite. Look in verse 1. He's a Midianite. So we have a priest of Midian. That means a leader of another people has come to see that Israel's God, Yahweh, is the true God. And this is part of God's promise to Abraham way back in Genesis that, hey, Abraham, through your family, I'm going to bless all the families of the world. And so for Jethro to rejoice in Yahweh and his power and his deliverance and then offer sacrifices to Yahweh, that's huge in terms of reminding Israel their vocation as God's people. It would have been a really concrete thing for Israel to see that God is not just working in them, but he's working through them as well. Now, still have a big chunk to go. Let's pick up in verse 13. Verse 13. The next day, Moses sat to judge the people. Now, judge here is a very layered and important and pregnant term, and we'll come back to it in just a second. Moses judged the people, and the people stood around Moses from morning until evening. When Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, saw all that he was doing for the people, he said, what are you doing? Why do you sit alone? All the people stand around you from morning till evening. And Moses said to his father-in-law, well, because they come to me to inquire of God. And when they have a dispute and they come to me, I decide, same Hebrew word as judge, I decide between one person or another. And I make them know the statutes of God and his laws. Verse 17, Moses' father-in-law said to him, yeah, what you're doing is not too good, man. You and the people are certainly going to wear yourselves out, for this thing is too heavy for you. You are not to do it alone. Now, obey my voice. I'm going to give you some advice, father-in-law, and God is going to be with you. You shall represent the people before God and bring their cases to God, and you shall warn them about the statutes and laws and make them know the way in which they must walk and what they should do. Moreover, look for able men from the people, men who fear God, who are trustworthy, who don't take a bribe, and then place such men as chiefs among thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens, and let them judge the people at all times. Every great matter they shall bring to you, but any small matter they can decide, Hebrew word for judge, for themselves. So it will be easier for you, and they will bear the burden with you. And if you do this, hey, Moses, if you do this, God will direct you, and you will be able to endure, and all the people will go to their place in peace. Verse 24. So Moses listened to the voice of his father-in-law and did all that he had said. And Moses chose able men out of all of Israel and made them heads over the people, chiefs of thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Verse 26. And they judged the people at all times, and any hard case they brought to Moses, any small matter they judged themselves. Then Moses let his father-in-law go back to his own country. I don't know if he was relieved. Maybe. We'll see. Now, a few things to keep in mind in this last section, a few things that are very crucial. Don't let the irony and beauty of a non-Israelite coming to see Yahweh as true God, don't let him, in the middle of the people, telling God's people how to obey and trust God, don't let the irony of that go. That's really beautiful, really powerful, very intentional here. But one of the most important things in chapter 18 is the idea that Moses judged the people. Now, this Hebrew word is the word shafat, which is a really fun idea, and it's really fun to say. So we're going to say shafat really loud on three. One, two, three. Very nice. Now listen, auditorium two, if you didn't say shafat, I have people over there. I'm looking at you. Now listen, shafat doesn't mean that he condemned them. That's what we think about judge. He didn't condemn them. He didn't look down his nose at them. That's not the thing. No. This idea, shafat, this judging is about making God's design, making God's plan clear and plain and understandable. It could be a legal and like formal thing. It could be just giving good advice or guidance. The word can also mean to deliver or pronounce a verdict. Also, if you're paying attention in the book of Exodus, this idea, the shafat thing, is kind of like a joke. Back in Exodus 2, when Moses was still known primarily as an adopted Egyptian guy, he saw these two Hebrews fighting, and they were at each other, and one guy punched another one, and Moses goes, "Hey, excuse me, what's going on?" And one of the guys goes, "Hey, why don't you chill out? Who made you judge over us?" Well, like, the up on the joke comes 16 chapters later, and that's, "Oh, Yahweh did." Yahweh made Moses shafat, judge over Israel. He put him in this position, and this shafat thing is a leadership idea. Furthermore, the original audience here of Exodus would have been very familiar with the book of Genesis, and that's the first time we see this idea where Abraham calls Yahweh the shafat of all the earth, the judge of all the earth, in Genesis chapter 18. So this is important. Israel understands Moses' judging as a part of their relationship with God, and as an extension of God's perfect and righteous judgment. It's very important for us to keep that in mind as we think about this stuff. Okay, now we need to take a step back, and we need to try to wrap our arms around all this, because we just did a lot of Bible. Congrats, way to go. Some scholars actually wonder why these two stories are in the Bible. They go, "Hey man, if the point of Exodus is the set free from slavery thing, and then the next point is the, hey, here's the Torah and the law thing, why throw these two like little tiny leadership stories in between all that? Why do that?" And some people actually think that it was just added later and it's no big deal. Well, first off, I think these stories prove the historicity of the events. So if the Exodus story weren't true, it would be a little weird and superfluous to add and include these narratives. But more than that, the people are getting ready to get God's instruction, God's law, at Mount Sinai. And what we just read is a way of preparing us as readers and a way to remind Israel that, hey, yes, absolutely, the law is good and it's from God, but God has also given you leaders to help you as you seek to live out the law, to live as God's free people. Now, that, and there's this one more thing, and this is why I know that God intended these things to be in the Bible, is there are so many tiny little connections between the two stories. For example, in both stories, Moses is sitting in leadership over the people, and the same verb sit is used in in both stories. In both stories, he's leading strenuously in a thing that lasts all day long. It's an all-day event, and it says that the sun goes down on both days. Also, in both stories, because it's an all-day event, he gets really, really tired from leading. You know, leaders get tired, that's the deal. So in both stories, it says specifically that he grows weary. Also in both stories, people are chosen to help him and support him as he leads and Shaphat, and he judges God's people. So the point is, we're supposed to read these two stories together. They're meant to be read together, and we're supposed to be listening for what is said through them. Now, one more thing before final synthesis here, and that is the people themselves. I hope you know this. If you've ever read a leadership book, you know this. How the people are doing is the strongest indicator of the health of any leadership, right? How are the people doing that are being led? That's the commentary on the health of the leadership, because weary leaders produce weary followers. Now, they've been grumbling for a few chapters, but we don't have any of that here. Maybe they're starting to realize God's provision, and maybe the Amalekite victory was a big thing for them. But there are a couple things about the people that we need to see. Look in verse 18, chapter 18, verse 18. Chapter 18, verse 18. You and the people with you will certainly wear yourselves out. Meaning, the people need to be considered. They're going to get burnt out if the leadership is burnt out. And so Moses takes Jethro's advice, and he finds some good guys and puts them over thousands and hundreds and fifties and tens. Now look down, one more thing about the people. Now look down at verse 23 at how it ends. The people will go to their place in shalom. Now this is a massive Jewish idea. It's way more than just no war. Shalom is like the ethos and the fabric of Eden. It is wholeness and prosperity and harmony and unity. And this means that humble leadership done God's way for God's purposes leads to shalom. It yields peace for God's people. Now, we just did a lot of Bible, and there are so many little things in there that I wish we could take a rabbit trail on or sidestep for 20 minutes on. But the broad stroke thinking is not just for you, it's for me. So here we go. Can we think about leadership in a way that elevates our view of God and that empowers us who lead and those of us who follow? So I got just a couple of observations as we try to answer this. Here we go. Number one, biblical leadership is ultimately about responsibility, responding to God and for others. Biblical, and listen, you, in your business or whatever, the book of Exodus is not written to help you in business. I'm talking about biblical leadership, how God wants his people to understand it. Biblical leadership is ultimately about responsibility, responding to God and for others. Where do I see this? Thanks for asking. I see this in Moses' obedience after the Amalekite victory to write the stuff down. That's why we have Exodus 17. In 18:14, look at 18:14. It says that Moses' leadership is for the people. And then in verse 19, it says that he is bringing their cases to God. Moses also, in verse 16, it says that he wants to help the people know God's statutes and know God's ways. This is the Shaphat idea. The point is that Moses sees his judging the people as his following God. Or, if you will, Moses sees what he's doing as his responding to God's leadership. Now we have to, like, press this thing into our lives. Any area of responsibility that you have, according to this idea, any area of responsibility you have is also an area of leadership. And any area of leadership that you have is both vertical and horizontal. You're supremely and ultimately not responsible to mom and dad, not responsible to boss, not responsible to teacher. You are supremely and ultimately responsible to God, vertical, and you are responsible for the sake of other people, horizontal. This goes for where you work, not just where, but how you work. That's both an issue of following God and doing it for the benefit of others. And to answer that, you have to think about how God wired you and how God gifted you. And not just think about it, but then are you using that to put him on display? Are you using how he made you and how he hardwired you for the sake of others? I've talked to a lot of people who are like, well, Thompson, I'm not going to hear that from you because you're a preacher, so your job's super spiritual, but I'm just punching a clock, and my job's not as spiritual. And maybe you think that. Maybe you think, hey, I just go to work so that I can get some money, and then I can eat and pay rent and mortgage. Maybe that's how you think about it. If you think about your responsibility like that, your little arena of leadership, then this is one of those things I wish I could take a step aside and talk for 20 minutes about, but this is a great book to check out. It's called Garden City. I have a picture of it for you. There it is, Garden City, Work, Rest, and the Art of Being Human by a pastor named John Mark Comer. He's from Portland. And this book is a super refreshing look at how we're all called to certain kinds of leadership and work. And he does a great job of looking at those things in view of God's big purpose and plan and story. Whether you're CEO or stay-at-home mom or local business owner, or if you're a cubicle king, you know, anywhere in between, God, this book is a great job of how has God wired you and how is work a good calling and thing. I will tell you when this idea hit me personally. Sarah and I had just got engaged, and I was trying to start think about marriage more holistically, since it was a reality now, like right on the future for me. And I probably stole it from some pastor. I don't remember where I first heard it, but I remember it was a big instrumental category shift for me when I started to think about my relationship with Sarah as first and foremost obedience to God, and then love for her. I knew I was getting ready to be this, hopefully, like really hopefully humble leader of a new family. And so God changed my thinking. Listen to the prepositions. My relationship with my wife, Sarah, is first and foremost obedience to God and then love for her. It's both, but there's an order to it. There is a cart before the horse. And these categories are the essence of good leadership. Biblical leadership is ultimately about responsibility, responding to God and for others. Also, I really do think we failed if we don't appreciate the humor in this passage. It is a father-in-law telling a son-in-law, hey, here's what's up. All right. This is like the plot of a rom-com. I've been there. I know you've been there. Maybe you used to be there as son-in-law, and now you're there as father-in-law, and you're like, oh, no, I'm doing it. Okay, I don't know. But here's the point. Jethro's being really cool about it, okay? He's not being a weird, annoying father-in-law. He's being really great about the whole thing. He actually has Moses' best interest in mind. Look down at verse 18. Look. He says, this thing is too heavy for you, and you're not able to do it alone. Meaning he wants Moses to win. And more than that, he wants the people to win. Like this guy Jethro, he's a new follower of Yahweh. He's like, I now know that your God is the greatest of all the gods. You're the one true God. And so he wants his son-in-law to win, and he wants God's people to win. So what he does is he goes, Mo, listen here, buddy, just come over here. You need to just kind of take some of my veteran wisdom for a second. I'm a leader. I'm a priest in Midian, so I kind of know how things work. Just take my advice for just a second. And the advice specifically is Moses, you need to learn a little bit of delegation. And this idea leads us to my second observation this morning. Here it is. God has designed leadership to be shared. Therefore, unshared leadership, it actually hurts those who are leading, and it hurts those who are being led. God has designed leadership to be shared. Therefore, unshared leadership, it hurts the people who are leading, and it hurts the people who are following. That is why in a family, God's design is a mom and a dad. That is why in a church, God's design is elders and deacons. And I'm so thankful that we have a plurality of leadership here, and nobody calls the shots. We're a team together. Also in the church, God's design is a variety of spiritual gifts and not just a bunch of people with the same giftedness. And don't forget, we're trying to think about leadership in a way that elevates and lifts our view of God. And this idea takes us there. And here's how. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And God made Adam and Eve, not to go, hey, go play. I know this fun new world. Go have fun. God made Adam and Eve to live in partnership with him, to reflect his goodness all over the world, to lead with him and for him and cultivate God's new world for God's own glory and beauty. That's creation leadership. And we get a glimpse of that here in Exodus 17 and 18. This is redemption leadership. God has just redeemed his people. And as Moses and Israel partner with God, they reflect his goodness as they share leadership and responsibility with him amongst themselves. So just like the picture of Aaron and Hur holding up Moses' arms in 17, we see the same support in a different way in Jethro's advice. So look down at verse 21. Jethro encouraged Moses to find men who fear God, who are trustworthy, and who hate a bribe. And these men are going to help in the Shaphat, making God's ways really simple and plain for the people to understand. Or, as it says in verse 22, they will help bear the burden with you. God has designed leadership to be shared. I do think this is important and can really kind of get into the nooks and crannies of our life, no matter if you're like CEO or whatever in between. So let me just comb this out for just a second, and I'm going to use the word responsibility here just because I think it flows a little bit better. Here we go. Shared responsibility encourages action. Hoarded responsibility results in burnout. Shared responsibility leads to peace, and hoarded responsibility leads to frustration. Shared responsibility is divinely driven, and hoarded responsibility is personality driven. Shared responsibility promotes trust, and hoarded responsibility promotes pride. Shared responsibility reflects Eden, God's design, and hoarded responsibility runs from Eden. Look at these positive ideas. Look at them. Action and peace and trust and Eden, those kinds of things. These are realities about shared leadership that point us back to God, but at the same time also invite us and energize us to further faithfulness. And these things are true in all spheres of life and influence. God has designed leadership to be shared, and when it's not, a kind of unraveling begins, both for those who lead and for people who follow. And unlike last week, I'm glad we have a good example with Moses. Last week, not so hot example about passing the test. This week, we do have a good leadership example in Exodus 17 and 18 with our friend Moses here. Now, before we wrap this up and tie a little bow on it, I do want you to hear something. I know you hear it when we preach. I just want to kind of explain it. Charlie and I, when we end our messages, we want to view whatever we're talking about through the lens of Jesus and the good news about him, that he has come to undo the mess that we've made of God's world. And we don't do this, we don't end our sermons like this to try to be innovative in our preaching because we're not that smart. Rather, Jesus repeatedly says of himself that he is the reality that the Old Testament points to. So the Hebrew Scriptures, what we call the Old Testament, is this layered history, but it's like a shadow and Jesus is the substance. So if we do Exodus well, it will always fall right on Jesus. That's why we've been calling Exodus the Old Testament gospel. That's how the New Testament writers think about it. Now, with that in mind, I see three connections between our Exodus leadership discussion and the life and ministry of Jesus. So I just want to hit these really briefly, three connections between what we're talking about and Jesus. First of all, when Moses appoints people over, okay, you got thousands, and you got hundreds, and then you got fifties, and you got tens. When I read that this past week, I went, oh, I know this. That's exactly how Jesus does ministry. Jesus ministered to the thousands, right? Time and time again, we see that in the Gospels. He ministered to the thousands. At one point, he sent out 120 people to go do kingdom work. That's like the hundreds. And then another time, he sent out 70, which is like the 50s. And all the time in the Gospels, he's hanging out with 12 guys all the time, pouring into them time and time again. We see that. So not only does this make Jesus the perfect leader, but in my mind, think about the implication. It implies that healthy followers should follow in various contexts. So go ahead. Hopefully this hurts a little bit. If you're here 1.5 times a month and you're just trying to keep a seat warm and that's the end and grand total of your spirituality, I don't think that's healthy. I don't think it is. I think being in a context like this, a larger context, all the way to the other end of the spectrum with the tens or the 12, like a small group, having your spirituality expressed, your following Jesus expressed in different contexts, proves kind of a healthy view of God and what he's up to and how he wants to lead his people for the sake of the world. If that's how God did it in Exodus and that's how Jesus did ministry, I think it'd be wise of us to kind of do the same and follow suit. All right, another connection. This one was really fun. Last week, we talked about how Israel passed through the waters of the Red Sea and then they went to Mount Sinai. And in between, they were tested three times in the wilderness. And then we went to Matthew chapter 4, and Jesus passes through the waters of baptism and then does the Sermon on the Mount. But in between those, in Matthew chapter 4, Jesus is in the wilderness, and he is tested or tempted three times. And unlike Israel, Jesus passes the test. That was pretty fun last week. But this is really, really great. Also like Exodus, do you know what Matthew does? Man, I love the Bible. Matthew, right after the wilderness of Jesus and right before the Sermon on the Mount, he throws a little thing in there. Jesus is leading, but he's also calling people to lead alongside him for the sake of the crowds. That's where Jesus calls the 12 and goes, hey, this is what we're doing. That's really, really beautiful to me, and I think very intentional. And this is where personal application is terrifying and wonderful. Listen, if you are a Christian, God has called you to be a part of his leading his people for the sake of the world. He has called you to partner with him for the sake and furtherance of the gospel. And that means you need to change the way you think about work and leadership. Hey, Peter, you might still fish. Follow me. I will make you fishers of men. The point is, you're following Jesus. It's not coming to church 1.5 Sundays a month and taking in a couple of bullet points about God and sin and grace. It's about partnering with God and being responsible before him. Shared leadership with Jesus in the power of the Spirit. That should haunt you, and it should be just as glorious as it is haunting. That's exactly why Jesus called the 12 to begin with in Matthew chapter 4. And finally, last little gospel connection here. And I'm compelled to end kind of where we started back in Mark chapter 10. Jesus is very clear that the way the world does leadership from the top down is not how Christians should do leadership. It's not how we should think about it. His followers should think about leadership as sacrificial and responsible servanthood. But not vaguely, like gritting our teeth and holding on really tight because it's up to us. It's first and foremost about believing him and trusting him because he gave his life for us. He says in the Mark 10, I did not come to be served, but to serve and give my life so that sinners could truly live and not die. And far more than Moses, Jesus stretched out his arms and he won the victory. And now we're called to hold him up as our crucified and risen servant king. Jesus is in person the Shaphat of God, making God's plans plain, delivering God's verdict. And watch this. Jesus' obedience was to God and for others, and it led him to the cross. Now, we're supposed to follow him there, trust him, and then lead other people there, right? And here's what I love. And if this happens, we get our New Testament version of Exodus 18:23, the people will go out in peace, or shalom. So, Fellowship Greenville, I think there is a way to think about leadership that raises our view of God, elevates our view of God, and it empowers us as leaders and followers. But the way to do that is to start and end with our victorious Jesus who has conquered sin and death. So I hope you're believing that this morning and that any leading you do is really just following him. I hope that's the case for you this morning.